Deuteronomy 21. If a man is found slain, lying in a field in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess, and it is not known who killed him, your elders and judges shall go out and measure the distance from the body to the neighboring towns. Then the elders of the town nearest the body shall take a heifer that has never been worked and has never worn a yoke, and lead her down to a valley that has never been plowed or planted, and where there is a flowing stream. There in the valley they are to break the heifer's neck. The priests, the sons of Levi, shall step forward, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister and to pronounce blessings in the name of the Lord, and to decide all cases of dispute and assault. Then all the elders of the town nearest the body shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck had been broken in the valley, and they shall declare, "Our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it done. Accept this atonement for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, O Lord, and do not hold your people guilty of the blood of an innocent man. And the bloodshed will be atoned for. So you will purge from yourselves the guilt of shedding innocent blood, since you have done what is right in the eyes of the Lord. When you go to war against your enemies and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, and you take captives, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman and are attracted to her, you may take her as your wife. Bring her into your home and have her shave her head, trim her nails, and put aside the clothes she was wearing when captured. After she has lived in your house and mourned her father and mother for a full month, then you may go to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. If you are not pleased with her, let her go wherever she wishes. You must not sell her or treat her as a slave, since you have dishonored her. If a man has two wives, and he loves one but not the other, and both bear him sons, but the firstborn is the son of the wife he does not love, when he wills his property to his sons, he must not give the rights of the firstborn to the son of the wife he loves in preference to his actual firstborn, the son of the wife he does not love. He must acknowledge the son of his unloved wife as a firstborn by giving him a double share of all he has. That son is the first sign of his father's strength. The right of the firstborn belongs to him. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who does not obey his father and mother and will not listen to them when they discipline him, his father and mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders at the gate of his town. They shall say to the elders, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a profligate and a drunkard." Then all the men of the town shall stone him to death. You must purge the evil from among you. All Israel will hear of it and be afraid. If a man guilty of a capital offense is put to death and his body is hung on a tree, you must not leave his body on the tree overnight. Be sure to bury him the same day, because anyone who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. You must not desecrate the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. Deuteronomy 22. If you see your brother's ox or sheep straying, do not ignore it, but be sure to take it back to him. If your brother does not live near you, or if you do not know who he is, take it home with you and keep it until he comes looking for it. Then give it back to him. Do the same if you find your brother's donkey or his cloak or anything he loses. Do not ignore it. If you see your brother's donkey or his ox fallen on the road, do not ignore it. Help him get it to its feet. A woman must not wear men's clothing, nor a man wear women's clothing, for the Lord your God detests anyone who does this. If you come across a bird's nest beside the road, either in a tree or on the ground, and the mother is sitting on the young or on its eggs, do not take the mother with the young. You may take the young, but be sure to let the mother go, so that it may be well with you, and you will live a long life. When you build a new house, make a parapet on your roof, so that you may not bring the the guilt of bloodshed on your house if someone falls from the roof. Do not plant two kinds of seed in your vineyard. If you do, not only the crops you plant, but also the fruit of the vineyard will be defiled. Do not plow with an ox and a donkey yoked together. Do not wear clothes of wool and linen woven together. Make tassels on the four corners of your cloak you will wear. If a man takes a wife and after lying with her dislikes her and slanders her and gives her a bad name saying, I married this woman, but when I approached her, I did not find proof of her virginity. Then the girl's father and mother shall bring proof that she was a virgin to the town elders at the gate. The girl's father will say to the elders, I gave my daughter in marriage to this man, but he dislikes her. Now he has slandered her and said, I did not find your daughter to be a virgin. But here is the proof of my daughter's virginity. Then her parents shall display the cloth before the elders of the town, and the elders shall take the man and punish him. They shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the girl's father, because this man has given an Israelite virgin a bad name. She shall continue to be his wife. He must not divorce her as long as he lives. If, however, the charge is true and no proof of the girl's virginity can be found, she shall be brought to the door of her father's house, and there the men of the town shall stone her to death. She has done a disgraceful thing in Israel by being promiscuous while still in her father's house. You must purge the evil from among you. If a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, both the man who slept with her and the woman must die. You must purge the evil from Israel. If a man happens to meet in a town a virgin pledged to be married, and he sleeps with her, you shall take both of them to the gate of that town and stone them to death. The girl, because she was in a town and did not scream for help, and the man, because he violated another man's wife. You must purge the evil from among you. But if out in the country a man happens to meet a girl pledged to be married and rapes her, only the man who has done this shall die. Do nothing to the girl. She has committed no sin deserving death. This case is like that of someone who attacks and murders his neighbor. For the man found the girl out in the country, and though the betrothed girl screamed, there was no one to rescue her. If a man happens to meet a virgin who is not pledged to be married and rapes her, and they are discovered, he shall pay the girl's father 50 shekels of silver. He must marry the girl, for he is violated. He can never divorce her as long as he lives. A man is not to marry his father's wife. He must not dishonor his father's bed.
Pretty heavy stuff, huh? Now, sometimes when we read the book of Deuteronomy, we're trying to say, okay, what is it telling us? Let's begin with chapter 21 first. Any comments? What did you see? What do you understand? Remember, I asked, what did you understand? I don't want you to ask, I don't understand this. I want you to say, what do you understand first? And what do you see?
One of the commentaries about verse 22 and 23 says that since there is not, he says, if a man commits a sin worthy of death and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, that since there is no death sentence in the Torah of hanging someone on a tree, the death sentence is stoning, that the reason that they hung a person on a tree after they were stoned is because death came through the tree. And that even a person was stoned who had...
Are you talking about the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Okay.
Right. And that even at that, the tree was hanging them on a tree was symbolic because the tree was what cost us all our lives.
Any other comments?
Well, the only reason you would do something like that is... as an additional example for some reason. I mean, if you've already stoned the person, what else can you do to them? But it's almost like this is like revenge. Like you hear the stories like during the Protestant Reformation, like, you know, in the Wycliffe, for example, who had died like 100 or 200 years before the Reformation actually started. What do? They dug up his bones and they turn around and burned him. It's like, what's the point? The guy's been dead for 100 years. And that's what this almost reminds me of. It's kind of almost tempering the desire for revenge. It's not enough that you stoned him. You want to hang him on a tree too. And he's telling them, if you hang this person on a tree, don't just leave them up there to let the birds eat them. You need to bury the person the same day. There's something here that's
unclear yet, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, Bill.
It says, cursed is he who hangs on a tree. So it's kind of publicly saying, besides killing this guy, he's cursed after this.
Is that part of the curse Yeshua suffered on the cross?
Yeah. Is that also a foreshadowing or a...
Oh, definitely, as it says that in the New Testament. It's very, very clear on that one.
Because, you know, it was one of those things that the crucifixion did not kill him.
Yeah.
So just like the person who's hung on the tree, the pike that they impaled him on did not kill him. He was
did
already
not kill
dead.
Him.
Yeah.
So he really wasn't, but he's worthy of death.
This commentary says it's an Assyrian practice. The Assyrians actually impaled. It's kind of like, I think, like the British would hung, draw, and quarter you. It's like, yeah.
The British would leave there for months or
Years. Yeah. So the Assyrians practice, it says, the eye to Assyrian practice understands this impalement on a pole or a gibbet. Though the Mishnah, which was way later, of course, has in view hanging the corpse to a kind of cross after the execution. And tree, one might recall, in older English usage, can refer to either a gallows or to a cross.
Right, gallows or a cross,
yeah.
Correct.
That's what the Mishnah is, the fact that there is no Torah command to ever kill somebody by hanging them on a tree.
That they were
already dead.
Well, that's the Mishnah. That's the Mishnah ruling.
Right.
That's a little different than...
Well, right, but the insight statement.
Right, I understand what you're saying. Any other comments?
Wait.
Well, what was the curse? It says, cursed is he who hangs on a tree. What was
the capital?
No, that's a question.
Oh.
Yes, I'll answer your question here. Yes.
Well, again, he asked what the curse is. This is like if someone does something that's worthy of capital punishment, you know, of execution. So they are cursed to die. That is the curse.
There's nothing to do with after death. Then.
No.
No, they're cursed to die.
Okay. And that's the reason why Yeshua was cursed. Why was he cursed?
Because he hung on a tree.
But what did he do?
He took upon him that.
Took upon him that was worthy of being on a tree.
Yep.
Most stonings are done. Most killings are done by stoning, and basically keep on stoning them until they're dead, and then you just pick up the body and you move it into a cave or somewhere so that it will decompose. The bones do not get decomposed. But this is a different kind of a curse. Okay? It's one thing to be, if you are worthy of, quote, let's say you got stoned to death because of this and because of that. You know, like we talked earlier or next chapter about two people being married. Guess what? You got to execute them. But they were just stoned. They were put upon a tree. All right? Now, why is it so important to put them on a tree? Or on a piece of wood? Let's get down to what we're really talking about here. Yes, Daniel.
Well, just strictly based off examples that I'm running through my head right now, the only ones that I know of that were put up on a tree were all kings. Kings were the ones that were hung. Peasants weren't, servants weren't, sinners weren't. Kings who sinned, they were the ones that were hung up. They were the ones out there, bodies were mutilated, hung up from a tree. Or they were hung before they died, because Absalom, I think, hung up on a tree there. his own
fault. They had no choice.
It's designed, for example, for a particular class of people that seems to be an issue for hanging over a tree.
For a public figure.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that king, what do they do all their lives? Well, they're being exalted their entire life. They make other people exalt them. If they're not exalted, that's kind of enforced exaltation. I think it's symbolic somehow. I don't think I understand the full symbolism there. But of hanging him up on a tree, it's kind of like almost like a contrast to he desired to be elevated, so he ends being elevated.
We lift him up.
Now wait, keep that part of the thought in mind. What did Jesus say? As the serpent was
lifted up.
Okay, the same symbolism here we're seeing. So Daniel has a point to listen to here. We're not talking about someone who is worthy of... Why is a curse? Because something has happened here that is greater. And actually it winds up being as worse than an abomination, yes.
Why? How was the serpent lifted up?
When Moses...
Put it on a pole.
Put it on a pole.
When they were getting bit by the snakes.
Yeah, the vipers and...
You ever seen the medical things that we're talking about?
Yeah.
They have the cross with the serpent wrapped around it.
Yeah.
Okay. That comes from biblical days of Moses' time. Kind of interesting to know where that came from.
Yeah, because it's really interesting, especially in the type of the serpent, in Hebrew, it's a very interesting thing about the serpent on the pole. Because in Hebrew, the language is like a sign or a symbol on a banner. It's like you've got the double meaning that this is like something you need to look to because it's a symbol upon a banner, so to speak.
And he's supposed to be taken down by that day, okay, before sunset, because it's not something to be glorified. All right, there's a reason why. They moved him down on the cross because of the mere fact that they're obeying what the Torah said. But, you know, it also was a whole high day coming, or it was a high day, and they didn't want that to take place during that particular point in time. Yeah, this has direct relationship to the Messiah. We know that because the New Testament tells us about the very thing. I want to back up just a little bit. All right. And I can't remember, someone needs to help me out. It's either in Matthew, where John, could be in the book of John, where Jesus has made a statement. And his statement was that the people say about John, the Baptist, was da 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 da. And the Son of Man, they say, he is a gluttonous and a wine bibber. That's biblical. That's right here in this chapter. All right, we need to carefully read it because it's very interesting because, see, in the Jewish world of the ones who are, I'm not going to name the group of Jewish believers, not believers in Christ, but ones who believe very strongly that what happened to Jesus for him to be put upon a tree or a cross or a stake is justified. And they use Deuteronomy to prove that as a point. And the best day to ever have that done would have been on the 14th day. Because to be cursed. Yes?
It's Matthew 11.
Matthew 11.
Yeah.
Okay, would you read it?
Yeah, it says... You want the whole passage?
No, just that section, if you can.
Okay, it says, what can I compare this generation with? They are like children sitting in the marketplace calling out to each other. We made happy music, but you wouldn't dance. We made sad music, but you wouldn't cry. For Yohanan came fasting, not drinking, so they say. He has a demon. The Son of Man came eating freely and drinking wine, so they say, aha, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Well, the proof of wisdom is in the action it produces.
All right, now look again here with that point. Verse 18, the rebellious son. Now, put yourself in his shoes for just a moment here. Let's say each one of you have a son. Right? Now, he's of a certain age. He's not a little kid. He's grown up. He's an adult. And listen to the words. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son, I'm reading this from the King James New Version, who has not obeyed the voice of his father or the voice of his mother. What is it talking about here? All right? It's really odd for a grown man having to obey the voice of his mother and the voice of his father, correct? Does it sound logical? Now, we can understand a teenager with a nasty voice, smart-aleck, but the Bible really doesn't have very many nasty teenagers and filthy voices. I mean, very seldom do you find a young child being sentenced to death for something that, you know, it doesn't exist. Very rare. So we're looking at something. Remember I told you about the Ten Commandments? Thou shalt honor thy father and thy mother. He wasn't talking to little children. Talking to grown adults. Grown men and grown women. They are the ones that are to honor their mother and their father until their mother and father, well, they stood to honor them even after their death, tell the honest truth. They are not, because they are the ones going to be responsible for not responding. So basically we're having here not a little kid or a teenager, rebellious one out there on drugs and on alcohol and everything else and reckless driving and wants to run away from home. We're not talking about someone who's depressed, who has hopelessness. We're talking about someone who really is doing something contrary and it's not obeying his mother and father, not the issue so strongly. It is not honoring. All right. Now let's continue on. And when they have chastised, it's a little hard to chastise a grown man, will not heed you, then your father and your mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of the city, to the gates of the city. They shall say to the elders, this son of ours is a stubborn and rebellious, and he is not obeying our voice. He is a gluttonous and a drunkard, a wine bibber, and a gluttonous means you eat an awful lot. All it does is eat and drink. What did they accuse Christ of? Eating and drinking. What? You mean Christ was fat and probably and he was, what? No. This is not talking about physicalness, although it's a physical principle here. We're reaching into the Messiah here. Do you understand what I'm saying? And that's what he, the Messiah, was accused of. What was he accused of? You are not honoring. You're not respecting, what, your mom and your dad?
The fathers.
The fathers. Not obeying the traditions of the Sanhedrins and of the elders. Because how often they said, well, your disciples, how come they not obey the commands of the elders? And the elders and what are the ones? I can't remember out of hand. But the members of the Sanhedrin. Because those are the ones that are supposed to be honored and respected and honored. Highly. So we're going up here in this ladder. And that's what this very same thing we see written here. It was the very same thing that Christ is accused of. Now, were they accused him of? Being what? Stubborn and rebellious. What do you think they called Christ? Well, he was a what? Sinner of sinners, kept friends with sinners of sinners. Yeah. He was rebellious. That's worthy of death. All right. Then we go on this thing about, versus he is hanged in a tree. You see the connection between the two? We see a physical law here. We see something that's very physical. And it's very, very real. It's very, very true. But we see, have to look at it farther on down the line where it was heading us. I don't know if Moses understood what he was saying at that point in time, but then he may have. I don't know. Because the 18th chapter, which we all read, was a very, very interesting chapter, right? So now we come in here and we're seeing something of a picture of the cursed of God. boy, worthy of death. Right? We have a combination of these things. And what she's saying is that he was stoned. That's right, he was stoned. And that possibility, I'm not saying that's true, and that possibility after they stoned him, they may have hung him on a tree or a stick for but a limited period of time. The curse is not to remain, by the way. Right? The curse is supposed to be buried. Not to always remain. It goes away. All right. Now, there are some of these things in this chapter which I don't have a complete answer to be honest with you, but I do see respect on it. That one about the female captive, that's really an odd law, isn't it? What do you think it's telling us?
There's actually quite a moral code for the period.
It's a period for eternity, though. Not just that time.
Yeah, but for the time, God is actually showing God's mercy here. For example, if you have read the Quran, you know it is quite okay for the Muslim to go on in and rape and pillage and have sex with as many women that his right hand captures. So here, at least the woman is afforded some sort of dignity in that she is taken, her head is shaved, her female.
So we'll tell you that God is
a new beginning.
God disagrees with the concept of rape and molestation of women when you go in there and you, what happens if you do? You're in serious trouble. It doesn't say here if he has received death or not. If he did it, just says this is how you're supposed to treat someone. If, right? Which is captive, and it's kind of an unusual law, I have to grant you, but even American GI, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We've had American GIs in Iraq do things they should never have done, and they have transgressed the word of living God. Even though they may go to church every Shabbat or every Sunday. You can't get away with it. We live in a country that believes in God. We live in a country that establishes it. So, you know, that's one of those things. In a grant, it's not just a moral code that was established then. It's a moral code for all eternity. All eternity. And if you decide you didn't like the lady afterwards, guess what? You can't sell her. You can't. What do you got to do for her?
She's free.
She's free. Like a free woman. A free Israelite female. She is free. She is not a concubine. She is free. She can go and come wherever she wishes. Mm-hmm. This is a thing with God. He does not like women being mistreated, even in such circumstances as war. I'd be very disappointed if my son did this. But that's just me. I would have hope he had moral codes higher than that. Well, somewhere along the line, codes have to be set in. We have a military code of justice. Of course, it's been radically changed since I was there. But nonetheless, there is code of justice that should be done. All right. Now, the law of the unsolved murder. What do you think about that one? Yes.
Who has to pay for the heifer?
The closest town.
The whole town.
That town. The city council or the...
So they all have to pitch in and buy the heifer.
Well, the city has funds. The city would pay for it.
Now, this is called... We have it in our country, our city. It's jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. This is where it comes from.
Yeah.
Comes from the world. Let me go. Okay, there's a boundary line. Oh... Body's on what side of the line? Well, Moses on this side. That's where I have to do an investigation of the death. That's what, you know, that's what cities and towns, they always quarrel about it because it's biblical. Where the body is found, that is where the jurisdiction is, and that's where they do an investigation and they do the thorough search. They're allowed to, biblically, go across that line and see if there's somebody else over there did it. You know. They're allowed to do that, but they have to thoroughly find it. This is a circumstance that's very fascinating because how often are there unsolved murders?
Often.
Every day.
Yeah. That's a lot. All right. Now, it's interesting to think about these unsolved murders that we have. What does God say to solve the problem? I want a atonement for the dead body.
Then it's complete.
So it's completed. You have what we call, what's our modern term today?
Restitution,
or a what?
Like restitution, or
restitution. Okay, that's a good one. There's a television program named after this. Closure, right? You have a closure. The issue now is finished and over with. But they must do certain things with God. They must make an open statement that they, our hands have not shed this blood, nor have our eyes seen it. Provide this atonement. That is a red heifer. Now, the red heifer has to be a special kind of red heifer. Can't be worked. Right? Never had a plow on its back. And had to be done in an area where it's never been plowed.
What is the significance of the unplowed, unsown, in the valley near a brook or a stream?
With
an unworked red heifer.
Anybody got past that? You want to say something?
Not yet.
what chapter is this particular?
21st. So first. 1, 2, and 3, all the way through the 6.
We can't remember verse order here.
Up to 10.
It's a pure area. It's a pure
not
area.
Not been polluted. Nothing is. Nothing. No plow has touched the land.
So it's clean.
Yeah. So it's clean.
So that's in a case where you have someone who died, you know. It was a victim.
The victim.
And atoned for with the stuff that was pure.
Now, I'll tell you who keeps the record who killed who, though. Yeah, right. We don't have to worry about that. So basically, we have in this country of ours, we hold on to something for a very, very, very long period of time. And we actually could solve a problem with an awful lot of closures if we just believe the Word of the Living God. Because they were putting this into the hands of unsolved murderers, into the hands of the Eternal. Yes. And what comes around will come around.
For the local jurisdiction to declare that that their hands did not do this, that, I guess, would give some pretty strong imperative to the type of investigation they have to do.
Oh, very strong.
Because they can't just flip them and say, well, okay, we...
They had a thorough investigation. In fact, they're probably more investigative than we would be today. Yes.
Well, it's an interesting thing that...
Well, I couldn't say that completely. It's not maybe the truth.
That God would hold the people accountable.
That city.
That death would be on them.
Correct.
Though they knew nothing of it, possibly.
Right.
I was just going to say this is related to Cain and Abel because you've got the pollution of the soil with a murder. It pollutes the soil. There's a pollution going on. And the word Adama is the land and Dam is blood. There's a wordplay in this going on too. So, yeah, it's very important because the New Covenant quotes, doesn't it, the blood of righteous Abel crying out from the ground.
Okay, before we get any farther, I want to get on the next chapter because I got a little time here, I think, before we get lost here. I want you to focus your mind in on the 5th verse. What does it say?
The priest, the son of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to serve and to bless in the name of the Lord. And every dispute and every assault shall be settled by them.
Yeah. Lois, right. Here are the investigators. Right?
Yeah.
Now, why would he want the Levites to do this? Why would he want the priest to do this?
The Urim and Thummim.
I'm sorry, what?
The Urim and Thummim.
A lot of power in it behind it, right?
They're impartial. They don't own any of the land.
They don't own any of the land.
So they're going to be you got,
okay.
Slaves.
You see the pattern going through here?
Yeah.
How beautiful it is?
Yeah.
It's kind of like nowadays, like, you know, if there's a serious murder in a town or whatever, like, unless they have a small town, they call in the FBI. The FBI don't have any ties to the area. They have no reason to favor maybe the
one
son
way or the other.
The son of this person.
There is no jurisdiction of police, one side or the other.
Yeah.
No jurisdiction of whether or not the highway patrol has jurisdiction of what happens on the freeway or whether or not it happens in the city. And all, who has authority? Now listen very carefully. I think it's very fascinating, though. It says, He, God, has chosen them to do two very important things.
Minister to him.
Bless in the name of Yahweh. And their word, every word they will solve, and what they say final will be settled. They make the final decision, by the way.
Wow.
Now, we don't think of Levites taking charge. Yeah, we're talking about a murder here. Yeah. We're not talking about religious stuff and doing all the holy things. Yeah. We're talking down to earth things that happen. And it's only the Levites that can do this kind of work. Mm-hmm. Not the local police, not the local leaders of the city. The leaders of the city have to be there. Leaders of the city that turn this whole thing over, they have to give us and be a full help and assistance to the Levites.
Well,
you cooperate with the authority, put this way.
Does this?
He had a solid comment. Yeah.
Oh, it leaves God in charge through the people.
Now you got it. Yes.
And furthermore, does this speak to a yet future situation as the ecclesia who are called to rule and reign with Yeshua in a future messianic kingdom, dispensing justice? This must reflect that same principle, right?
Yes. That's how they will rule and reign.
If we are priests to him.
We are priests. And when the holy time comes, when the time comes, when it's instituted, we will be the ones who will investigate unsolved murders.
Based on Torah.
Now, what's interesting, though, we could say, well, you already know who did it. Well, no. The people have to make a decision. They have to make a decision of whether or not they want to listen to and do what? Heed to what the priest said took place. Because, you know, the high priest is whom? The Messiah. This is how the city, or group of people, will learn to lead and yield unto the high priest. And our high priest is Jesus, we know that. It's kind of interesting how you can put these things back there. It seemed like a little bit archaic. And bring it all the way forward. You know, our country is not in that world because our country is in its own world. But, you know, it's a beautiful thing if we kind of have some resemblance of it, right?